Welcome to the Grow My Salon Business podcast, where we focus on the business side of hairdressing. I'm your host, Anthony Whittaker, and I'll be talking to thought leaders in the hairdressing industry, discussing insightful, provocative, and inspiring ideas that matter. So get ready to learn, get ready to be challenged, get ready to be inspired, and most importantly, get ready to grow your salon business. Hey, it's Anthony here, and welcome to today's episode of the Grow My Salon Business podcast. It's great to have you here with us today. I started out in the hairdressing industry a long time ago, and so I have met or worked with some of the biggest names in the industry, many of who had a great impact on my development as a person and as a professional hairdresser. In 1980, I first started working at Vidal Sassoon in London, and amongst the many incredible people from that era was Annie Humphreys, who is, without doubt, the most famous colourist of all time. Anyone who knows anything about this industry will know of Annie. The story goes that Vidal bought an existing salon where Annie worked, and all the staff left except for Annie. So she was effectively Vidal's first employee in the famous 171 Bond Street salon in the 60s. Annie went on to become a part owner of the company and only retired when the Sassoon Salons and Schools were sold in the early 2000s. And although she is now in her 80s, she is still fit and healthy and a force to be reckoned with. I had the pleasure of interviewing Annie for an audio series I did in 2015 called Grow Unplugged, which was my first foray into podcasting. And so today's episode is a re-release of that interview from 2015. This industry often has a short memory that sometimes builds people up as icons, which is a word that is totally overused. But Annie Humphreys is an icon. She is a giant in the industry, and if you're a hair colourist today, you owe much of what you do to the path that was walked before you. So I hope that you enjoy this interview with the one and only Annie Humphreys. Welcome, Annie.
Thank you, Anthony. Great to be here with you.
Annie, there may be some young hairdressers who don't know, of your history. So we need to start at the beginning a little bit and go back to where it all began. You started in the 1950s. You were an apprentice in London. The salon you worked in was then bought by an unknown young man by the name of Vidal Sassoon. And legend has it that he gave all the staff working there the option to leave or to stay. And you were the only one who chose to stick by Vidal and turn his plan of groundbreaking modern salon into reality. Is that about it? Have I got the story right?
Perfectly correct.
Okay. Now, can you remember that? So you're working for someone else who owns the salon. Who was it who owned the salon?
His name was Jose Powell.
Right.
And he was a completely different type of hairdresser to Vidal. He was a very old school in a way.
Right.
That did competitions and all that, very intricate, sort of very meticulous, very, very artistic.
Okay.
In his mannerisms.
Yeah.
But I thought, well, I don't know.
And so when Vidal came and took over, were you the only staff member? Was it just you and him, or did he bring someone else with him?
He brought his staff with him.
Right. From where? So where was he before
that? We were in 171 Bond Street.
Right.
New Bond Street, which is two doors away from Aspreys.
Right.
And definitely in the right area, which was very important in those days that you were in the right area.
But I thought the first salon was up the other end of Bond Street.
But Vidal had his small salon, which was his first salon, at the other end of Bond Street.
Right, okay.
Which was Oxford Street end of Bond Street, over a shoe shop called Mondaine, which is right next door, or up on the third floor.
Yeah.
Which is right next door to where Stephen Way's salon is.
Right, and so was that the one that you were working in? It wasn't.
No,
right. Okay.
I was working in 171, the salon that
the
everybody
iconic
knows.
Big salon, right. Yeah. And that was the one he came and took over?
Yes.
Oh, I didn't realise that.
Yeah.
Okay, so he already had a salon on Bond Street.
He already had a salon.
But he brought those people down.
It was, because it was in those, it was up by Oxford Street.
Yeah, sure, yeah. And it was on the third floor at the back.
Yeah.
Yeah, looking over the yard or whatever.
Where this was right on Bond Street.
Yeah, opposite where Cartier is or Ralph Lauren. The 171 Bond Street, the big salon in Bond Street, he had that as early as the 50s, in the late 50s.
It was 1958.
Well, I thought that was it, because that was the year I was born. Yes. So, yeah, okay.
But the first salon that he actually had was 1954.
Right, which was the one up at the other end, the Oxford Street end. Yes. Okay, so you stayed, all the other staff left.
The staff worked in the big salon for a month or so.
Mm.
While he was planning what he was going to do with it, because he wanted this to be very different from most of the other places. And obviously it took a while before, you know, all the plans.
And so he was an unknown at this stage still.
Yeah.
In terms of like all the big names in London weren't Vidal Sassoon. And so he took on that big space in Bond Street.
It was the ground floor, the basement, and the first floor.
So what was it like when in those days working with Vidal? So he's a stylist, he's behind the chair doing a full column of clients every day. At this point in his life.
Yes. Yeah. Oh yes, yes. Okay. And in the beginning he did use rollers, but not rollers as most people would think about.
Right.
He used to have his rollers made every day.
Made. Right, okay.
From cotton wool.
Right.
So the assistants used to have to get the cotton wool and roll and roll and roll and roll and roll and press until they got this perfect
cylinder.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
In all different sizes.
Yeah.
And he had a basket of these rollers. And also pins.
Yeah.
He would do pin curls as well.
Mm.
And he would just use two pins to keep the pin curls in place.
Right.
And they went in tick, tick, like that. Yeah. So quick, you wouldn't even see them go in.
Yeah.
And most of the assistants used to fumble because they couldn't pass the pins quick enough for him.
Yeah, exactly. So when he was working then, and you'd be watching him as like a young hairdresser, did he stand out as someone who was just like, this guy is so talented, or was it still early days yet?
He was always different. He always had a sort of very different approach to people in this kind of, the only way I can think of it is it was very open. It wasn't hushed at all, because a lot of the people in those days, the tones were quite hushed.
Yeah.
And in some of the salons still had like cubicles. You see, everything was sort of closeted and quiet and hushed. And and he was very, very open and not loud, but everybody could hear what he was saying or what he was talking about.
Mm.
You know, so it was quite, it was just different.
And how did he, in those days, how were clients treated? How were staff treated? I mean, we're talking 1958, 1959. I mean, it must have been a very different, you know, compared to what it's like now. Did apprentices pay to come to work in those days?
Yes.
So if you're an apprentice, you had to pay to be there.
A lot of people came.
Right.
And paid.
Yeah.
Not everybody.
Yeah.
By the time everybody got back working full swing in 171. There were apprentices that he took on that didn't pay, that got very minimal wage. And then he took on people that wanted to pay to learn his ways.
Right, okay.
And we called those people Varderers.
Right, yeah.
And they watched during the day.
Yeah.
Because it's an old theatre word. Harder for looking, for watching. So because they watched all day, they got nicknamed Varderers, and to this day it's stuck.
It's used everywhere. Everyone uses it now. Yeah.
And in the evening they would be allowed to do a model, and they had to pay a big premium to do that.
Right, okay.
And there was just a small amount taken each time. There wasn't masses of people because he didn't want loads of people cluttering the place up. So it was very privileged because they learned quite a lot.
How many staff would have been there in those days in the salon?
I think we must have had about 20 stylists.
So a big salon.
Hicks, yes.
So you know, Vidal has never made any secret of the fact that he came from, you know, very humble beginnings. How did he finance this big salon, which it was a big salon still, in Bond Street in those days?
Well, I think he was just one of those people that he was lucky. He was very lucky. I think in life you have to be lucky as well as talented.
Yeah.
And he met a New Zealand sheep farmer.
Really?
Sheep farmer.
Oh, there's hope for me yet then. Yeah. Okay.
And somehow must have just clicked with this gentleman.
Right, okay. So New Zealand sheep farmer financed Vidal Sassoon's first salon or big salon on Bond Street.
Yes.
Right, okay. And was he a partner in it? Or was this purely an investment? He got his money back after X amount of time.
You never saw this gentleman.
Right, okay. He was too busy on the farm.
I don't know the intricate details of the financial side, but I know that's where the money comes from.
I've talked to a few people about the fact that I was talking to you today, and there was some interesting things that people asked me to make sure I asked you. But one of them also said, she said, now, ask her questions about today. Like, ask her things about what advice would you give to someone young starting out today? So what would you know, a 16-year-old today starting hairdressing, if you had to give them a one-sentence bit of advice, what would it be?
Make sure it's what you want to do, because it's not easy.
That's for sure.
And if it's what you want to do, then you have to work hard at it, unless you are a complete natural.
Mm.
And in all the years that I've been working, there's not 50% of people that are natural, not naturals.
Yeah, not even nearly.
As you know, it's a small percentage that it just comes.
Yeah.
So to be really good, you have to work hard at it.
Yeah.
And if you put everything into it and you work hard at it, you will get a lot out of it.
Yeah.
But if you put your toe in the water and then take it out again, think about it, and then, maybe, it won't work for you.
You're wasting your time. I agree with that. What about a young salon owner? So someone who's just opened their salon today, what advice would you give them as someone who used to be part owner of Vidal Sassoon? I mean, what would you say to them?
Well, it's obviously, I'm saying it's obvious, but sometimes because you're so wound up about trying to build up a clientele, trying to, you know, get the people into the salon, right, and getting your name known, don't neglect the figure side, because if your numbers don't add up,
yeah,
it doesn't matter how many people that you've got coming in the door. It won't be a success, because your numbers have to work out in the end.
Yeah.
It's boring, I know, but okay. First of all, I agree. You look after the work. You also have to look after everybody in that place. And remember, you are not the most important person in the salon.
Mm.
Your staff are more important than you are.
Mm.
Because without them, you ain't going to get anywhere.
Mm. Yeah, okay. All right, let's just get back to the 70s for a minute then. I know that you did a lot of work with some of the big stars of the day. I heard names like Dusty Springfield and Diana Dawes and Mandy Rice Davis and a lot of stuff with Vogue, etc. in the 70s. Tell me some stories about that.
I think it was so part of being – it was a bit normal, actually – because in those days, there were so many different people that were in theatre and arts of different sorts. And also, we had a large clientele of the ladies of the night that used to come into Bond Street.
Fabulous. Right,
it was a very, and duchesses and all sorts. It was very mixed. So it was a very sort of open. So you would have, you could have call girls, and you'd have royalty, and you could have cleaners, and you could have solicitors, and you could have, it was just a big mismatch of all sorts of people. So whoever came in, it was quite normal, and nobody really thought more of it.
Yeah.
People used to fly in from Paris quite a lot.
Yeah.
New York, people used to come in from LA, people came in. But it was just kind of, because it wasn't unusual, it happened with different people all the time, you just became a bit blasé, I suppose. You just expected it to be normal, but it probably wasn't.
Yeah, yeah.
And also in those days, everybody was larger in life in any case.
Right. So when are we talking now, still late 60s, 70s?
70s,
okay.
Early 80s.
Right. And I gather in the 70s, from what I've been told, is that there was a lot of work done with magazines. It was quite common for you to be doing work with Vogue and stuff like that. Is that right?
Yes. I mean, Vidal did quite... Vidal, this is probably something that people don't know, but he was probably the original session stylist.
Really?
Because he would go to Paris and take Roger Thompson with him.
Yeah.
And they would go and do the magazines. And they would go and do the shows. And he would do magazines in London and stuff because he'd done the Paris shows and the Milan shows. So it wasn't called session then because it was the beginning, really.
Yeah, because I know a lot of models used to do their own hair and makeup.
Yes.
They'd bring
their
own shoes and all that sort of stuff, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
Yeah.
In those days, most of the models did their own hair.
Yeah.
The photographic sessions were not as they are now. The shoots weren't, you know. It was all very style and contrived and stuff like that.
Did you ever do that side of things? Did you ever get into dressing hair yourself?
No.
Okay. So was there ever a decade or an era that was particularly inspiring for you? Was there one decade that you went, oh, that's when I was hot? That's when, I mean, okay, Anna, you were hot all the time that I was, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s.
Well, but I suppose as colour became an accepted thing, when I say accepted, when I first started, I used to do, or in Bond Street, when the bob, right, the 5-point, obviously is dark.
Yeah.
And in those days, we did loads of work. It was either blonde or black.
Yeah.
Or red.
Mm.
You know, so it was very mono. And also that, I suppose, it went with the haircuts, which were all perimeter. It was all about lines on the outside.
Sure. Yeah.
And then the haircutting got towards working with interior shapes.
Yeah.
And then people were having colour because of the haircut and stuff like that.
This is sort of when I turned up then, isn't it? Yeah. So beginning of the 80s.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But before that, people had their hair coloured when they were in the theatre.
Yeah.
You know, starlets or in the theatre, or if you're a cool girl, and they had brighter colours, the more flamboyant stuff. If you were not from that era, it's the type of, you came in and you said, please, can you do my hair, cover my grey up? Yeah. I want it to look as natural as possible. I don't want anybody to know that my hair's tinted.
Yeah.
Then it changed for people to say, oh, yes, I would like people to notice my hair's coloured.
Right, okay.
So it's a change from people not wanting to look tinted or coloured to saying, oh, yes, I do it. It was kind of accepted.
Yeah.
It was a bit like when lipstick first came out. People didn't want people to think they'd put red on their lips.
Yeah, they just bite their lips for a bit, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
To make them go red. Okay.
And then, of course, we had the crazy colour era, which was very strong.
Taking it to the extreme.
Yeah. I mean, the punk and stuff like that. I think one of the things that people probably don't realise that there's a very unsung hero of cutting called Daryl Benson.
Yeah.
And he's really the forefather or the grandfather, the godfather, whatever you want to say, of cutting as we know it today.
Mm.
Because the way that he cut was to make hair shorter to support longer hair. So it was really
the first concave and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, the beginning of the concave. And people had not thought of making structure out of a haircut.
Yeah.
Really. Or they were doing, you know, going away from Vidal's perimeter into the interior shapes, which they'd done before where they just layered stuff through, but it was just to kind of layer all over.
Sure.
Where this was actually like building a house. So you were building a haircut to, you know, to support one area to support another. And that's really when the colouring came into its own, because you then made areas darker and lighter to enhance the shape, and you'd use the darker colours to make the hair recede and the brighter colours to make it pop out. So really that, all the cutting, that when that really started getting really intricate and stuff like that, then the colours went in tandem with the haircut. So I think that was...
So this is now early, mid-70s, and so Vidal, by this point, he's gone to America.
Yes.
Yeah. And Christopher Brooker is also in America.
Yes.
So you're in London.
Yeah.
With Daryl Benson. Mm. Who else from that era? Other unsung heroes?
If we just hop back a little bit to Christopher Brooker.
Yeah.
we did the first bicolour together, which was the Firefly. And that was in 73. 73. 74.
Okay, yeah.
73, 74.
Yeah.
And that was when that started.
Yeah.
And then he actually did the first coloured photograph of Adele.
So it had all been black and white up to that point?
And, that main photograph was in black and white, but there was one coloured photograph done of it. And also at the same time, there was a he did a haircut called Urte, which was blood red, and that was coloured.
Okay.
But both of those were coloured by hand, and all the retouching was done by hand. He was very pioneering, Christopher. He was completely different from Roger Thompson because Roger took over from Vidal and he was different. Then you got Christopher that was different again. Then you went from, then you had a short period with Herta Keller, who was talking about girls. She was very strong, so she held a very strong position. And then you came into the Tim Hartley era.
But the, before the Tim, there was the Daryl Benton.
Yes, but he did not become international creative director.
Right, okay, yeah, of course.
Yes,
right.
But directly before Tim, you had the Daryl Benson that did a lot of the, what I think was the godfather of the haircutting. And I think if you speak to Tim, he'll probably tell you the same.
Yeah, yeah. There's two names that pop up often, Daryl and Flint.
Flint, yes.
Who used to work together a lot, didn't they?
Yeah, Daryl came up with it, but then Flint worked very, very strongly with Daryl.
Yeah.
And they're both very, very pioneering, very, very different.
Yeah. So in this period of time, just talking about Sassoon as a company, you know, Vidal's gone.
Yeah,
he's
in
America and he's working on developing products and stuff.
Yeah.
The company itself must sort of, well, I know, without putting the words in your mouth.
Was that, a bit
yeah, it
split.
Was it was split and it was, as a business, as you just said before about the numbers, you've got to know the numbers.
Yeah.
Obviously, there were times, like any business, where it maybe lost its way a little bit.
Well, I think because Fidel was concentrating on the products, right, and he spent most of his time in the US, there was this kind of split because we had the Daryl Benson Flint thing, which was hair, progress, colour, progress, hair, doing stuff. You're pushing the boundaries, hair-wise. Vidal was pushing the boundaries, the other side of the pond, on products.
Yeah.
So he was still pushing the boundaries, but in a different way to the way we were doing it in the UK.
Yeah.
And the UK never, ever lost this push, you know,
creative.
Yeah, it's...
Yeah. But business-wise, there was a lack of...
It was, yeah, it was...
Control or was, lack it, of leadership or a lack of business acumen at the top?
No, no, well, for... No, we had Tommy Yeardye.
Yes.
Who was managing director.
Yeah.
And I think maybe you try to do different things. Maybe we try to spread our wings a little bit too far in opening in different directions. In the 70s was the first salon outside London, which opened in 73 in Manchester. 74, it went to Leeds. Also in that, at the same time, we opened in Munich. And then about a year or so later, we opened in Hamburg. And then a year or so after that, we opened in Frankfurt. The same time as we opened in Hamburg, we opened in Milan. And then we opened in Birmingham a bit later than that. So there was quite a lot all going on in the same, you know, expansion at the same time. And always when you try to expand very, very quickly, you're always, you know, stretching your resources in every direction.
Yeah. So often, I mean, you never hear about the things that didn't work. And it's an amazing company that's had a great history. But I'm always curious about things like you just mentioned then. So Birmingham. I arrived at Sassoon at the end of the end of 1980, and just before I arrived, Croydon had closed, Birmingham closed, and somewhere Wilmslow closed.
Yeah.
So that must have been
It was just after that. Which I'm saying, it was wrong in the wrong place at the wrong time.
Mm.
And also, I think it was too early to be in those areas.
Yeah.
And I mean, we closed Milan after a few years as well because. Yeah. Milan was not the place at the time for Sassoon because they had not got into that hair. And also because of business, the salon didn't open right on a main big fashion street.
Yeah, sure.
It was tapped away in more of a residential area.
The Milan one you're talking about.
Yes, right. Which was the wrong move, especially with the Italian mentality. Mm. Was not the wrong place, wrong time, you know. And plus, we were too early for Italy.
Yeah. So with like the Croydon salon, the Wilmslow salon, the Birmingham salon, were they just hemorrhaging money? Was the expansion just too quick and there was a lack of management
or what? That was taken in Birmingham was huge. Mm. I mean, huge. And we only opened half of it, which was huge. And the other half stayed closed. It was too big.
Yeah.
All the salons that were there were smaller salons. Mm-hmm. Although they had some good names there, they weren't, it wasn't this big place, you know?
Yeah. So this is now about the time I arrived at the beginning of the 80s. And that was when you and Christopher and Philip then took over ownership of the company. Mm. So you start off as a 16-year-old kid, and now all of a sudden you own the biggest name in the world of hairdressing.
You didn't think about it.
Vidal's in America, he's concentrating on the products.
And meanwhile, Tommy Yeardye had also moved to the States.
Right.
And Felicity Green came in to be the managing director, fabulous lady, obviously well-known journalist, but maybe not...
Not with the right business acumen to run Sassoons.
Yes, and also hairdressers are very strange people, as I'm sure everybody knows. We're all a bit odd. And you can't actually wave a big stick at them and tell them that's what they have to do.
Yeah.
Because if you do that, it definitely doesn't work. They like to have a certain amount of rope and freedom and
So who owned the salons at that point? Before you and Philip and Christopher
Vidal Sassoon Inc.
Of which Vidal was a shareholder.
Yes, and there were other, yes.
And they decided to...
They decided to let part of the salon group go.
Just the UK or UK and Germany at this time?
Only a percentage. And also at a similar time, the managers in the US had a small percentage in their salon. So now we're getting quite fragmented.
Yeah,
right?
Sure.
You know, because there's a small percentage of people running the UK, but they also had to answer to the corporation.
Yeah.
Because there was only a percentage that was held here by the three of us.
Yeah.
And then in the States, you had
individuals
just having a small percentage in their salon.
Right.
So obviously they were interested in their salon.
Yeah.
Because that's what human nature, that's what you, that's your pie.
Yeah.
So it was quite fragmented, obviously, because, you know, obviously people wanted to do very well and the salons were busy. And I don't think at that time the creativity and the leadership of following, breaking, you know, trying to progress and always bringing out new things and collections and moving forward was not really necessarily on their agenda. And also not just the managers, but the Americans as a whole didn't move forward as quickly in their fashion arena in those days as they did in Europe.
So the salon owners in America had a percentage of their salons, but it wasn't a franchise. They just got a profit-sharing percentage or something.
It was just, I don't know the details, but they had a certain... So you, just so you, in their own... Only in their own
salon. So you and Philip and Christopher took over ownership of the UK and Germany, or part of it, and then phase two, you took over all of it?
Yes, the UK.
Right.
And then the next stage was...
America and Canada.
Yeah.
Was there ever a day where you woke up and punched a year with a fist and went, yes, I've made it?
And no, you're too busy. No, not really. You had to be quite fearless and not think about it because everything that I own wasn't mine anymore.
Because you'd had to leverage everything.
It belonged to the company.
Because you'd had to leverage everything to borrow the money to buy into the salons.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
It didn't matter.
I know another red herring I want to just chuck in here. I know there was a school at one stage in Hong Kong.
Yes.
So what happened there?
Didn't work. Right. No. I think that was another one of Tommy Yeardye's babies. I think it was just really trying to get the mix of Western cultured people. There were people from the US and people from the UK that went to open the school and then trying to also bring on the Chinese, which they did. And they had quite a few people in the end that that were there that were Chinese that were on the staff. But I just don't think that it had enough of a pull for people to go there for education.
Yeah, again, before its time.
Yeah.
I think that's the thing people have to remember about Sassoon, is that it's done all these things that were groundbreaking. No one else had done them before. There'd never been a celebrity product line. There'd never been schools the way Sassoon did. They'd never...
But also, probably another thing that people don't realise, that when Bedell opened his second salon, which was Grosvenor House, and that was in 1963, he opened with a health bar and a nurse.
In the salon?
In the salon. Yeah,
that's very revolutionary, isn't it?
Yeah, so it's always been, you know, so we had...
What was a nurse doing?
She would give injections of vitamins. So, you know, it was very...
Very, very
different. You know, you went... It was a whole special area. And that phased out because, again, really...
Wasn't ready for it.
Too early.
Before its time.
Too early.
Yeah.
In Bond Street, we had our own wig department. We used to make wigs.
And I also heard in Sloane Street, you had like a full-time chef downstairs and all this sort of stuff.
Yes,
doing three-course meals.
Well, not quite three-course meals, but we had our own chef,
So you had your own wig department in Bond Street of making handmade wigs?
Handmade wigs.
Right, and this is for fashion?
Fashion.
Wow.
Because in the 60s, you know, the beehives and all of that.
Yeah.
And even when the Five Point and the, you know, the geometrics were in, there was still a lot of dressed hair going on. And that was still going on in the salon when Fidel was doing Five Points.
Yeah.
Because he didn't suddenly, one day, he did the Five Point and everybody had it.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't happen like that.
Exactly.
People change over. So we used to make false, you know, pieces so that you could have your hair up, down, long, you know, and also not so much for theatre because they had their own type of wigs that they wanted usually.
By now, when you're talking at this period of time, you know, beginning of the 80s, whatever, did you see Fidel much? I mean, was he a part of the business or was he now just so elevated in the States, his own TV shows, you know,
you wouldn't
completely
see him.
Obsessed
he
with
would
products,
come
etc.
And you'd probably see him for a half a day or something. I mean, he would visit all the salons.
Yeah.
But people wouldn't see him for very long.
Right. But did you? Did you have, I mean, because you had a different relationship.
Oh, yeah. You would see him, but
okay.
He was always.
And he was just the same guy?
Always the same,
okay.
Always the same. But probably people didn't realise that also one of the reasons we had our own wig department was when Vidal went to Paris and he did, like, Courage and all these fashion people's shows and they all had the Vidal Sassoon haircut. He'd taken all these handmade wigs. Not all of them were wigs,
but
there was wigs taken so that if one of the top girls wouldn't have their hair done, then they had a wig.
The look, Well, that's the main thing. Let me ask you about colourists. What is it that makes a good colourist? What do you look for? You've got some kid who starts with you in the salon and they're doing their, you know, their training and you're looking at them and thinking, would they be a stylist? Would they be a colourist? What is it that you look for? Or what is it that you should look for within yourself?
When you start someone in the salon and they're shampooing and stuff like that, you usually see which area they gravitate to. And majority gravitate towards cutting. It's just the odd few that are interested. They just show an interest in colour. Because most people want to do cutting, I think. Didn't you find that most of the people that came into the salon to be...
I never had any affinity with colour at all.
No.
None at all.
Exactly.
And I didn't want to get my hands dirty.
No, exactly. You know. So you know when you've got the juniors that come in, the apprentices that come in, there's few that migrate towards that colour department.
Yeah.
And then you nurture them and on. Others just don't want to go near.
Yeah, but that was me. They're also very different creative processes. Like from the point of view that when you cut hair, you see what you're getting as you're getting it. Whereas I always think that when you colour hair, you colour it and then you've got no real idea what's happening.
You have to know what you know.
Okay, so you hope you know what's happening, but it's not until it's finished and it's dried off that you can see it. Whereas if you cut an ear, you can go, oh, that needs to be a bit shorter, or I need to break that up a bit more. You can sort of see it as you're doing it, whereas with colour...
Well, you can have a look as it's developing to see if it's doing the right thing.
All right. Okay. So here's a question for you. Have you ever made a mistake or a hair disaster that couldn't be camouflaged?
Don't think so.
Okay. You always manage to get away with it.
I think
it's
you
back
can,
to those wigs again, is it?
Oh, no, definitely not the wig. No, I think you can. I mean, a mistake is never a mistake until it leaves your chair.
That's worth remembering.
Right.
Yeah, good.
And Christian Gardner, who was a great colourist with me for years, and I was used to say, it's never a mistake. And first time I met him, when he came for an interview and we got along, and I said, Jim, one, you've got to remember, it's never a mistake until it leaves the chair. And he never forgot that. And he would always say that to all the kids when they're learning.
Well, good. Well, no, it's good. It's a nice little sentence which has a very good message behind it.
So you can always, you know, if you see it, rectify it. Don't leave it. If you spot it straight away, if you know what you're doing, you can counteract it you can do it. Yeah. Don't leave it.
A lot of your job was always about developing a team of people, not just as colourists, as part owner of the company. You were responsible for building a team. What are the key things that you need to develop a good team?
You have to make them believe in themselves and that they are as important. They are an important part. And that I always think that, you know, I always used to say to the kids, because I loved when I used to do a lot of staff training, you can do this. No, they'd say, this is going to be difficult. No, it's not. Mm. It's not. You can do it. You can do it. Just think you can do it. Just think about it. You can do it. You've got to make people believe in themselves that they can do it. Mm. But because you've got to make them, they want to do it, you know, that they can do it. Yes, I'm going to do this. I can do this. I think that's, you know, they have to feel like they belong and that they are producing something and they're contributing and that they're important what they're giving to the whole thing.
Okay, and believing in themselves.
Right. Yeah, believing in themselves, they're that they are contributing to the whole, not that they're not important, because that they are.
How do you deal with failure when things haven't worked out for you, business-wise or, you know, people-wise, that have let you down, disappointed you, whatever it is? How do you deal with that so that you move on? What's your sort of philosophy on how you handle failure?
You can't change history. You just have to move forward and you learn from it. Because once it's done,
it's done.
It's done.
Yeah.
Don't do anything you regret, but never regret anything you do.
Was there any one thing, like what you've just given an example of, any one sentence or statement or idea or conversation that was said to you that had a real big impact on the direction that your life took?
Yeah, I think for now, because it was always, yeah, it'll work.
Was there any one thing he ever said to you, Annie, come sit down over here, I'm going to tell you this, remember it. Was there anything like that stuck with you that's been like?
No, we can do it, and we can do it. And I think that word is very important.
We. Now, you always had a phenomenal work ethic. I can always remember you were the first one there and you were the last one to go. Where's that from?
I think it's from my family, actually.
What did your family do? What did your mum and dad do? Were they?
They were in greengrocery.
So just like Margaret Thatcher's family.
I suppose so.
Yeah. So that work ethic.
Well, yeah, because obviously greengrocers used to have to go to Covent Garden Market very early in the morning. 4 o'clock in the morning, you were up and go to the market.
Yeah.
And then when you worked all day. And then when you came home at night, you had to balance the books.
Right. So you just rolled your sleeves up and got on with it.
Yeah.
And you were amazing. I would take my hat off to you. What do you think of colour today? Because it seems to be a lot more relaxed, the techniques and the rules of colour. When you look at colour today and you see what's happening, what are your thoughts?
Well, I think it's great, because I think there's some of the things that you can do now, because they're saying you can put colours on top, they're not going to bleed. Certain companies say this, and there's lots of things that have been developed which makes it easier. And also, I think everybody's so into having colour and changing it and having different things, and there's so many different colours out now. There are so many more things that are primary. You know, before you were very limited to primary colours and bright colours, where there's lots and lots of choice now, and I think it's great.
I was intrigued as to what you'd say by that, because I know you were always like the queen of foil, and now there's so much more looser, more freehand sort of stuff. Would you love to have had your hands in there doing more of that now?
I did quite a lot of freehand. I mean, do you remember
at the beginning with like flying colours and comb-ons.
Yes, yeah. And also all of those things with, you know, icing bags.
Yeah, that's true.
Rolling, putting colour on rollers and rolling it over the hair and all sorts of things like that. We went through this era, which was trying to make things very quick because the economy wasn't very well mapped. People didn't want to spend a lot of money going through a
crisis. And I think that's what's driven it again now, hasn't it?
Yeah.
All the balayage, freehand techniques is all about money and speed.
Yeah.
Get a result and get it quickly.
Quick.
You mentioned Tommy Eardai a couple of times, and I don't know him, obviously, but I knew of him. And I know that he wanted to take the company and franchise it a long time before franchising was happening. And that because it didn't happen, that's why he left. Do you think it should have been franchised? I mean, obviously they dabbled with the thought because you said salon owners in America had a slice of the action.
Yes,
of their
but
salon.
I don't. It depends. The word franchising is quite big and quite loose, isn't it? In a way, you see, the thing is, when Regis took over, they were going to do these studios, and they were going to roll out.
Yeah, 250 of them or something. Like
yes.
That. Yeah.
So that's why I say, no, it didn't go the way I thought it was going to go, because it was expected that it would do that. As we are now, people have done franchising or that type of thing, and it has worked for them.
Mm.
I think because there's much more control now, and people have learned, people have grown up, they've learned of the mistakes that, of the first franchises and stuff like that. And I mean, you know, Tony and Guy have done fantastically well from it. And it's because it's very well run. You know, Tony controls it, and all the people he's got do a fabulous job. So if one person can do it, why? It means it can be done.
So do you think that should have happened? Or is that in line with your statement about the past?
Well, again, is it the right time in the right place?
Right.
I think, no, I don't think it would have happened at that particular time, to be honest. I don't think it was the right time.
And when you and Philip eventually sold the company, was that a good day for you?
No.
Oh, right. Okay. So that was your baby. Yeah, that was a bad day. Okay. In 30 seconds or less, do you want to tell us how you felt?
Odd.
Odd. Okay. That's less than 30 seconds. I'll let you off there. So, Annie Humphries, you're in retirement now. Do you enjoy retirement?
I've got used to it.
Yeah? Okay. You'd never miss standing behind a chair?
Of course.
Yeah? You do miss that, do you?
Okay. Yeah,
all right.
Of course.
Now, I know that you were sort of plagued in your sort of last years behind the chair with shoulder problems, weren't you?
Yes.
But that was hairdressing inflicted?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Because being short, having to stand on my toes with my arms up in the air because all our foiling and all that is always on top of the head.
Sure.
It's just too long.
Right.
And
okay.
A lot of that is because I used to do a lot of shows. And so when you went out and did shows, it was very, very long days.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
To get all the things ready for going on stage, all the, you know, models that were on stage.
Anything you'd change?
No.
No, you wouldn't change a thing. What would you like to be remembered for eventually? One day and many years from now when you're no longer here and
colour.
People are talking. Okay. So nothing specific, just, you know, colour.
Just making colour exciting for people and accessible and accepted.
You have been an amazing influence to a lot of people over, 55, 56 years or whatever. You've influenced generations of hairdressers. And you certainly had an influence on my career and my life, which I'll thank you for. But I know that hearing you talk today, a lot of people everywhere would have been intrigued and interested. And I'm sure that everyone has learned something from what you've said today.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. If you'd like to connect with us, you'll find us at growmysalonbusiness.com or on Facebook and Instagram at growmysalonbusiness. And if you enjoyed tuning into our podcast, make sure that you subscribe, like, and share it with your friends. Until next time, this is Anthony Whittaker wishing you continued success.